To start the chain reaction, all we need is one neutron. We have inherited a wealth of knowledge from the great thinkers of the past. The atomic reactor then gives us a chance to make the atomic genie our friend. I think you can see what is going to happen. Watch.
Hello and welcome back everybody to this episode of Radio Nuclear. My name is Doug Hartmeyer and I am glad that you have joined me again for this other episode of Radio Nuclear. And I'm glad I can actually make it because you know what? I'm on the road right now and I'm in a hotel room. So if it sounds a little different, that's why. And also, if you hear a rogue vacuum in the background, just know that's completely outside of my control. And I won't be stopping just because of it. You know, the other thing I realized, too, is that every time I publish an episode of this, about 5 minutes after it goes up online, a big and awesome nuclear news story comes out. I'm hoping that by publishing on Sunday, I have at least a day until that happens. But we never know. But who comes here anyway just to listen to Doug drone in their ear about what the news stories are? We want to know who the guest is this week. And this week, I have Mr. Wes Deason, who I also had the pleasure of meeting at the ANS Winter Conference. Now, he's going to tell us a little bit more about nuclear and space, just like his co-worker, Dr. Chris Morrison. And I promise you that it is another very interesting interview about nuclear and space, and will probably be the last one on that topic we'll have for a while, since it is a very niche area. So hopefully I've hyped you up enough so that we can get into this episode's news stories. INL could soon host a major reactor center. That's the title of this week's article in the Post Register from Nathan Brown and was published on January 26th of 2019. The article begins, Idaho National Laboratory may soon be home to a major reactor testing center. Congress passed a bill last year to create a National Reactor Innovation Center to test and demonstrate private sector proposed and funded reactor concepts. While the U.S. Department of Energy has yet to announce where this center will be, it seems pretty clear and obvious that Idaho National Laboratory is the right place to do just this, INL Associate Lab Director John Wagner told the state's leadership in Nuclear Energy Commission at its meeting Wednesday in Boise. So nothing is confirmed yet, but it looks like there's going to be a big announcement that Idaho will likely receive a big nuclear reactor testing center beyond what we already know. So two things. One, I'm trying to get ahead of the big news stories this week. And two, it sounds like this is going to be an addition to what we already know is coming to INL. So what do we know is coming to INL? We know that they will be using GE Hitachi Prism technology to build the versatile test reactor, and that NuScale will likely be building somewhere on its grounds. John Wagner went on to say, quote, I don't want to get in front of my headlights, but it's hard to imagine it being anywhere else. He goes on to say that, quote, right now if you're a company like TerraPower that has a fast spectrum system and you want to test, you're pretty much going to Russia, and that's not helpful for our domestic technology development. The article then mentions about the upcoming exciting builds at the site, such as the VTR and NuScale. But more importantly, they emphasize how this gives INL a new purpose. A lot of people would say that in the last couple of years, there wasn't really a lot of demand for the research going on at INL. But due to the trend and revitalized interest in nuclear technology, we're beginning to see a lot of exciting stuff come out of the woodwork here. Wagner went on to go on and say that, quote, this is now a competitive market amongst these advanced reactor developers. This is a different future from what I say we would have been talking about even 10 years ago. Which seems to be true. Now, admittedly, when I was 15, I wasn't as into the nuclear discussion as I am now, if you could consider myself even being a part of it. But in 2009, think of how much was different. That was before Fukushima. That was kind of around when fracking was starting to become a big thing. You know, the conversation was a lot different. And we weren't really looking at these new type of designs and the potential that they could bring. But now, look at what we have on our plate. Really exciting times. And if there's anything that I can glean from this article is that there should be a big announcement soon. And hopefully this is some of the beginning signs of the U.S. getting into the advanced reactor game more so than what we have been. Also, just a quick policy update for you. The NECA and NEMA bills are signed into law. This news coming to us from Dr. James Konka in a Forbes article titled "President Signs Pro-Nuclear Legislation," which was published on January 24th of 2019. The article begins, "Two bipartisan pieces of legislation modernizing America's nuclear future have recently become law. The Nuclear Energy Innovation and Modernization Act, NEMA, directs the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to make regulations move more quickly with respect to new nuclear reactors and establish better and faster licensing structure for advanced nuclear reactors. It was signed by the president and became law last week on January 14th. The article continues, "The other law is the Nuclear Energy Innovation Capabilities Act, or NECA, that became law last September. NECA updates the mission and objectives of the Department of Energy's civilian nuclear energy programs, particularly supporting the development and deployment of advanced reactors and developing a reactor-based fast neutron source for the testing of advanced reactor fuels and materials." Now, what's interesting is that at the federal level, NEMA experienced almost no resistance. In fact, passed the House with a vote of 361-10 to approve the law, and then unanimously passed in the Senate. In addition to these two new laws, the DOE completed an environmental assessment that clears the way for fabrication of high-assay low-enriched uranium, or HALEU, fuel for advanced nuclear reactors, also at the Idaho National Laboratory. What a great news cycle this has been for INL, I tell ya. And I think it's probably one of the most upbeat ones we've had on this show for a while, which is great. Going forward now, Rick Perry has to make the pitch to Congress and kind of go over his 10-year budget plans, and hopefully those should get approval. But it seems like, you know, we're seeing more momentum in this new year for new nuclear than we ever have before. Now, unfortunately, you're still going to have people that are going to try to stand in the way of all this progress. As some of you may be aware, the NRC recently released a message saying how they're going to approach Fukushima-driven safety rules and responses, and some are a little worked up about that. So let's talk about it. The best middle-of-the-road article about this I could find was on Utility Dive, and it's titled, "NRC's New Fukushima-Driven Safety Rules Not Designed for the Real World, Critics Say." This was published on January 24th of 2019 and written by Robert Walton. So, what's going on? In the wake of Fukushima, the NRC wanted to take a closer look at operating U.S. reactors to see if there's any lessons learned from that incident that we could help improve our existing fleet. They've been doing this for about 5 years, and it seems to be appropriate given the fact that a lot would say that the storms that are striking the U.S. or striking plants are getting stronger and stronger. Right? As a result of all this studying, this new rule is going to require plants to maintain resources and procedures to cool a reactor's core and spent fuel pool in the event normal emergency power is lost. It would apply to operating commercial nuclear power plants and power reactor license applicants. Okay, this seems reasonable. It seems reasonable because the big driving factor in Fukushima is that they couldn't get backup power and they couldn't keep the cores cool. So what's the problem? Well, critics are saying that the regulators watered down the final rule, stripping out a provision that would have required plant owners to update their design, structure, systems, and components in order to protect against real-world hazards. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, the NRC commissioners voted 3-2 on a stripped-down version of the rule that commission staff recommended in 2016. Staff's proposal recommended requiring plant owners to protect their facilities from the, quote, real-world hazards they face today instead of the design-based hazards that were estimated using now obsolete information and methodologies when the plants were built decades ago. Union of Concerned Scientists say that regulators declined to require plant owners to strengthen their defense against even greater hazards. The article, quoting the UCS, goes on to say, "The commission's majority action today removed that requirement and will simply maintain the uncertain and inadequate status quo." And there you have it. The tried and true anti-nuclear argument of painting an image of uncertainty. They're saying that what we have right now is not good enough, and that implies a degree of uncertainty of, we don't know what's going to happen, but it's probably bad. Well, of course, you're playing right on someone's fear. But let's look at this from a wider lens. A lot of nuclear plants have already updated their systems post-Fukushima. Why? Because the NRC wanted them to. And so they did. Thankfully, the CEO of NEI, Ms. Maria Korsnick, stepped in and set the record straight in this article by saying, quote, plants were designed to withstand the most severe hurricanes, earthquakes, and other natural hazards as assessed by experts. After their construction, more than $4 billion dollars in additional equipment was added to protect against even more extreme events that were beyond design basis. Now, I'll get to what I think the silver lining is here in a minute, but let's just look at this as if we were coming at this without any precedent, right? What would you consider when deciding what safety systems need to be in place for a plant to protect against natural disasters? Well, you want to consider the natural disasters that could occur there, right? And we know that this is largely based off of where the plant is geographically situated. A plant operating in the middle of Kansas is likely not going to experience a tsunami. Is that a safe assumption? So if the Union of Concerned Scientists wanted a blanket rule that says every nuclear power plant has to upgrade its system structures and components to withstand Fukushima-level events, that's not practical, nor is it really needed, right? You need to look at the site that you're placing your plant at and assess what natural disasters are actually going to occur, and then build up your safety systems based on that. Use some sort of graded approach and site-specific approach for designating what safety systems you need in place. Naturally, there's going to be overlap between all the plants, but some may require more than others, right? I think if you read a little bit between the lines here, it's a little more apparent what Union of Concerned Scientists wants. And they want the financial burden of unnecessary regulation for upgrading safety systems, structures, and components on plants that are already financially distraught. Now, it's one thing if these are necessary, but as Maria already pointed out, we've already added billions of dollars in upgrades after completion of these plants, and the new plants coming in, you don't even have to worry about this type of stuff because they're passively safe. But unless you make that evaluation based off of a site-by-site determination, you may be doing unnecessary harm. Financial harm, that is. And here's the silver lining to this. Remember when I kind of established what I thought the common sense approach was going to be, the site-by-site basis? But when you look at the NRC news release on this, and I'll link all this stuff below, the very last paragraph says, the NRC and its nuclear plant licenses will continue post-Fukushima efforts outside of the rulemaking context, including analysis of whether additional safety improvements are necessary in response to updated site-specific seismic and flooding risk assessments. Well, that kind of sounds like that graded approach thing I just talked about, right? Bottom line is, I don't think I've met a single person in the nuclear industry that advocates for making plants intentionally less safe. That's not anybody's goal here. And a lot of these nuclear power plants, as we already stated, made significant upgrades following Fukushima. And as demonstrated, they went above and beyond what is necessary because that's what the nuclear industry does. We hold ourselves to a higher standard. What I like about this decision from the NRC, though, is that it does incorporate a site-specific clause instead of just a blanketed approach. They're not capitulating to the USC or those that are trying to be overly conservative. The safety record of U.S. nuclear power plants speaks for itself. Anyway, I'll admit it was tough to find information on this, and it wasn't because the information doesn't exist. It's just a lot of the briefings, the quick 5-minute reads on this, kind of all skewed to one side. So if you're interested in this, I'd encourage you to go look at more of the supporting documentation from the NRC, which a lot of their info on this is already publicly available, but I will link everything that I used in the description below. Also, should note, this was just an opinion take on my part. Feel free to read all the sources, find additional ones, and draw your own conclusions. I'd highly encourage you to do so. All right. Last story for the episode. And I'll be honest with you, I never thought I would be talking about it on a show like this. But I'm guessing that a lot of you who listen to this show are big fans of dogs. And if you're not a dog lover, then I'm sorry. You should probably go talk to a doctor. And as a person who himself is looking to hopefully get a dog here soon, now that I'm living the young professional life and have some space to myself, I couldn't believe it when an article titled, "Puppies from Radioactive Chernobyl are Starting New Lives in North America." You heard that right. You can now adopt a dog from the Chernobyl exclusion zone. This story comes to us from BuzzFeed News and is written by Jane Litvinenko. The story was published on January 24th of 2019. The article begins, "A dozen puppies with satellite dish ears and wagging tails scampered behind Natalia Malinchuk as she carried an oversized bowl of dog food. She stopped walking, turned around, and commanded the puppies to sit, showing off one of the four commands they're required to know before leaving the small Ukrainian town of Slavutich to find new homes." I should note, now's probably a good time, that if I botch the pronunciations of these, I do apologize. Anyway, these puppies are about to become the first dogs ever to leave an area known as the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone and live abroad with foreigners who've adopted them. The dogs have spent their lives in one of the strangest places on Earth, a region still grappling with the fallout of Europe's worst ever nuclear disaster. So essentially, there's a crowdfunding project going on over there called the Clean Futures Fund. And they put out some viral videos that got almost 6 million views of these dogs and was shared across Twitter accounts like We Rate Dogs and Darth. So these funds also help out people too, but admittedly, it seems like the dogs are the ones bringing in the bacon. Apparently, the co-founder of the Clean Futures Fund said that when they post stories of the children they help or other projects CFF works on, he gets angry emails from donors who want to make sure their money is going to dogs in Chernobyl rather than the people. He says, quote, "On social media, if we put up a picture saying, 'Hey, we helped send this kid to treatment, thank you,' we get 3 to 5 angry emails saying, 'I gave my money to dogs. You better not use my money on kids,'" Hickson told BuzzFeed News. Which, okay, that's a bit over the top for people who are writing angry emails saying that, how dare you help these kids. But it's still a good thing that even though the dogs are the ones that are raising a lot of the money, everyone stands to benefit because of these cute dogs. However, this, of course, draws a lot of skepticism. The article states that the whirlwind of viral stories about the dog program sometimes play up their radioactivity to the point of inaccuracy, but they also help CFF's visibility. One outlet called the dogs feral, and another claimed that the puppies couldn't be touched because of radioactivity, a blatant inaccuracy as the puppies are not radioactive. Hickson said that it's mostly grown dogs who could have radiation in their fur, and that's rare. They haven't come across a single radioactive puppy in the last year and have only seen one or two overall. The article continues to say that prior to 2018, it was illegal to bring dogs out of the exclusion zone, but last summer it was Malenichuk's job to help take care of the puppies and get them ready for adoption. Her sunny disposition is at odds with the horror she lived through some 32 years earlier when she was 6 years old and the Chernobyl power plant blew up. Now, Malenichuk dances with the puppies to their favorite song, Despacito, and names them after famous composers because, quote, "This batch likes to sing." Well, I'll link the story and a link to the website where you can donate, knowing full well that you'll also be helping out people as well as the animals here in the Chernobyl exclusion zone. It's certainly an interesting story, and as I say again, one I thought I would never be talking about on this show, but I like nuclear power, I like dogs, it worked. Wes Deason, coming up next. All right. Well, today we are lucky enough to be joined by Mr. Wes Deason, who I actually had the pleasure of meeting at the most recent ANS Winter Conference. These conferences, by the way, are just a great way to meet all sorts of people in the industry, but enough of me talking. Let's let our guests do the talking. Mr. Wes Deason, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Excellent. Well, it's a bit of a long story and goes back to my undergrad days when I started in nuclear engineering at Texas A&M University. And while there, I was helping out with our Boy Scout Nuclear Science Merit Badge program that we had there. And I learned about the possibility for nuclear power to be used in space applications. And that really triggered my interest in that I had interest in rocketry in space, even from a kid launching model rockets with my friends. And I wanted to learn more, and I found out that one of my professors, Dr. Bragg Sitton, who's currently at INL, she had done research in this area. And so a friend said, hey, go talk with her. She has a lot of experience in space nuclear. And I went and talked with her, and she turned me on to an internship out at Idaho National Laboratory, there for the Center for Space Nuclear Research. And at the Center for Space Nuclear Research, they focus on students and integrating students in with the Idaho National Laboratory. And they had a really cool program called the Summer Fellows Program. So I applied and luckily got in, and I came to find out later that it was very lucky that I got in. They hadn't had that many nuclear engineers apply that year, and mostly they normally only accept grad students, but because of who had applied that year, I managed to get in just as a junior undergrad. And so that's really where it started, with Dr. Steve Howe. He was the founder and the director of the Center for Space Nuclear Research for 10 years. And while there, he sort of became a mentor of mine. And we worked on some really cool projects that year. We were asked to design a really high power, which for space, it's high power, but a 20 megawatt power system for space. And we were told, you know, basically your only limits are physics. What is the most high performance system that you can come up with? And we explored that, and it was just a blast working. We worked with a team of aerospace engineers, mechanical engineers, and nuclear engineers to put this together. And just having that freedom to sort of forget everything about the cost, to forget everything about politics or any of the other constraints that we normally think about licensing as nuclear engineers, be able to sort of let yourself dream and come up with just what are the limits that physics can let you do for nuclear power. And that really inspired me, and I really enjoyed doing that. And I ended up taking some aerospace engineering classes my senior year at A&M and coming back and doing that internship again afterwards. And through that, I got connected with Oregon State University through Dr. Andy Klein. And there, Andy himself has a lot of experience in space nuclear power and fusion power. And so through him, I got connected and started my grad school work at Oregon State, and continued my connections with the center at Idaho. And after grad school, I had continued participation in the space nuclear community. I got connected with the Nuclear and Emerging Technologies for Space Conference that was being held that year. I believe it was down in Houston that year. And then also it's regularly held in Albuquerque. So I met with Dr. Steve Howe that year, and he connected us with Mike Houts at NASA Marshall Space Flight Center. He's the head of the nuclear rocket program there. And Mike told us, hey, we're looking at trying to revitalize the nuclear rocket program, and we need you guys to take a look at how does low-enriched uranium look when plugged into a nuclear rocket. And NASA was quite interested in this, because NASA generally works through commercial partners, and they work a lot, not often with nuclear materials, and so they're not so familiar with the security protocol that surrounds nuclear materials. And in the space nuclear world, often HEU is recommended as the fuel source because it enables you to have the smallest reactor, the lightest reactor. And so, but he asked our team to look at, can you do this with low-enriched uranium? And so we all got together that summer after I finished grad school and started looking at it, and we found that it absolutely was possible. We looked at some of the solid neutron moderators that were considered during the historical nuclear rocket program, and we found that by utilizing the cold hydrogen that is the propellant in the rocket, we were able to keep the neutron moderator cool while also providing propulsion through the engine, simply by running the cold propellant over the neutron moderator first, and then running it through the reactor itself. And so NASA was really excited and wanted us to continue looking at that. I ended up transitioning to being full-time out in Idaho, working on that project. And we continued to grow and work on that project. It became what we called a design exercise with NASA. And we created the Scotty rocket concept. Scotty referring to the Star Trek reference, but it really stands for the Space Capable Cryogenic Thermal Engine. And I continued to work on that project for 2 years. I also had the opportunity to work back with Dr. Bragg Sutton at Idaho National Lab, looking at nuclear hybrid energy systems. And that really opened me up to seeing what are the applications for high temperature reactors and other nuclear reactors for coupling with industrial applications and for complementing renewable energy in a decarbonized electricity grid.
You know, what's cool about that is that you said you were able to design without any constraints. And so what I'm thinking is you remove all the barriers and just lock engineers in the room and you see what they come up with. And now it seems like you need to apply that a bit for space because this is an outside of the box application. So what are some of the cool kind of things you see rolling down the pike in terms of innovations for space nuclear technology?
Well, so we always like to have a breadth of technologies come and present at NETS. Some of them very near term, some of them far term. We've even had speakers come and talk about the possibility for low energy nuclear reactions. Some people call it cold fusion, but there's a lot of research in that area if they are able to figure out, you know, is there the possibility for cold fusion. So sometimes we have those guys come and present. Sometimes we also have people come and present far out concepts where they're concepts that are like gas core nuclear reactors. So you have a giant gas cloud of nuclear material in your spaceship, and that glowing gas cloud either ejects nuclear material out the back as the propellant, or it heats up, you know, propellant. So these are things that, you know, normal nuclear engineers don't even think, you know, exist or even is a possibility. But there's some really cool stuff on that area. But related to in the near term, really cool stuff that's coming out. One particular thing is the nuclear thermal rocket project. So that's continued to grow. And as you may have heard, they have BWXT as their main fuel contractor on that project, and as well as Aerojet Rocketdyne as their main contractor as well. And so those companies are really forging ahead with actually manufacturing some of the fuel elements that are going to go into these technologies. Additionally, in parallel, you have Los Alamos National Lab in their kilopower reactor that started out with the Krusty test. Now, the Krusty test was done, I believe it was back in 2011, and The creators of the Krusty test, Drs. Dave Poston and Rick Kaepernick and Pat McClure, they got together and they looked at seeing how can we take what we currently have with just side funds and how we can take those and couple them together and with real materials we have sitting around Los Alamos, which, you know, is a unique capability, but they were able to take those out to the Nevada test site and take a heat pipe. A heat pipe is a self-contained heat transfer system, and plug it into that nuclear material and actually test what essentially is an analog for a nuclear reactor in space. And by doing that, it was groundbreaking. It was the first time that a heat pipe operated reactor had ever been operated, that you'd ever gotten power from that. And they did it with, I believe, less than $1 million. And it was incredible, you know, considering the amount of money that has been spent coming up with ideas and getting locked in bureaucracy. And it was inspiring to the entire space nuclear community that they were able to do this. And it's gone on since then. And and through a lot of support from internal funds at Los Alamos National Lab in actually creating a reactor core and doing a full-scale test at the Nevada test site of this core and going up to power and proving that it's inherently safe and that it's self-controlled. And it's really been inspiring to the entire community to see kilopower in the Krusty reactor be successful.
Right. And so with these things like heat pipes, you get rid of a lot of the moving parts. You can make the thing a lot more lightweight and get a lot more energy density, so more bang for your buck, so to speak, in a rocket or in a space application. So are there, what other sorts of things do you need to consider when designing a space nuclear system?
Yes. So one of the main considerations is you have to get rid of your waste heat in order to do any sort of thermodynamic process requires you to have a hot temperature and a cold temperature in order for you to transition that heat over. And that's how you get your power out from your system. And so whether you're dealing with a large steam cycle in a nuclear power plant, you still have your cooling water that provides the low end temperature, and you get rid of the entropy in the coolant. And so in order to do that, you need to have some sort of low end temperature. Now, the problem is in space, we don't have these rivers and lakes that we can just cool our reactors with. We only have the deep emptiness of space. And so to do that, you essentially have to make your low end temperature a light bulb. You have to radiate that heat away through infrared radiation, essentially. And to do that, they have certain materials that do that quite well, but the math says that the performance of that radiation material is a function of the temperature to the fourth power. And so the higher, even if you can get just a little bit higher temperature, you can reduce the radiative area that you need in space an immense amount. So that one characteristic and the characteristic that it is just expensive to launch anything very heavy into space, you really end up driving that temperature as high as possible in order to reduce your mass. And of course, there's a certain balance where you start getting more mass when you try and get to higher temperatures and higher powers, but that's balanced very carefully with the mass of the radiator. So that's really the first constraint that we have when dealing with these systems. The second one is their lifetime, especially when you're looking at a very small reactor that's going to be going very deep out in the solar system. If that system breaks down, if it's not reliable, if you have a part in there that fails, then you're not going to be able to fix it. You're not going to be able to go and replace that part. And there might be a backup part on there, but you would have had to plan ahead for that. And so the reliability of these systems is huge. That's really a main driver why we've stuck with, for example, in the Curiosity rover, a thermoelectric energy conversion method. It has no moving parts. It simply relies on the physics of semiconductors in order to create electricity. And just having that temperature difference across those semiconductors creates that electricity. And so that is the second main criteria that they try and build for. As we start getting into nuclear power systems that are going to live in Earth orbit or live on the moon, or perhaps even on Mars if you have people there as well, you're going to be able to make them a little bit more high performance. You have people available that can come in and do the maintenance on those systems and can replace things if they break. So as that constraint falls away, we can focus a little bit more on the performance aspects. We can focus more on the mass aspects and really crank up that performance.
Wes, I know you brought it up a couple times here, but I'm curious, what is this NETS conference and who should consider going?
Right. So to announce the conference, this February 25th through 28th in 2018, or 2019, my apologies, we are going to be having the Nuclear and Emerging Technologies for Space Conference. It's going to be in Richland, Washington, at the brand new Discovery Hall at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. And there at their beautiful new facility, we're going to be gathering together professionals from the Department of Energy Laboratories, from NASA, from industry interested in space nuclear power, aerospace companies, nuclear companies are coming together to talk about different applications of space nuclear power, of propulsion, of advanced technologies that are being considered, emerging technologies that are considered for space applications. And it really is the tight-knit community, the annual gathering of this group that many of them, they still continue to pursue space nuclear power, even though it's not the most traditional or even the most dependable source of an income. Many of them, it's their sort of side hustle or their side interest while they have their main, you know, work or project that they work on that they know they can get income on. Many of them continue to do this hobby and to look into it. So you find that because of that hard environment that's so driven by federal funds and the executive branch's guidance for NASA, you see that these people still keep coming together, and they're a real family that have just come together because they see the promise and they see the vision for this technology for space applications. So I encourage you to come. We're going to have some great tours at the B reactor. We're going to go see LIGO, the gravitational observatory that contributed to the discovery of gravitational waves a few years back. And we're going to have some really great speakers. We're going to have an associate NASA administrator come, Steve Jurczyk, and we're going to have John Kelly, ANS president, come, as well as a former astronaut who actually founded a electric propulsion company that primarily will depend upon the emergence of nuclear technologies. So it's going to be a really exciting time, and yeah, we get to see the beautiful Columbia River Wine Valley.
Yeah, I can testify to that. The Columbia Wine Valley is something, so you're not speaking out of terms on that one. But that's, of course, not the only draw to the area, and I encourage anyone that's interested in this nuclear and space aspect of nuclear technology, consider signing up for the NETS conference. The early bird registration ends on January 28th, and registration closes by February 11th. And again, that's at Discovery Hall in Richland, Washington. So again, go ahead, Google it. I'll link it below, and consider going. We'll be right back after this. Well, thank you, Wes, for those interesting insights into nuclear and space, and thank you for taking the time to sit down and tell us a little bit about what you do. For all those interested, I'd strongly encourage you to attend the NETS conference in Richland, Washington. The registration date, again, for that ends February 11th and is located at Discovery Hall in Richland, Washington. I'll link all the information below if you are interested in attending. It sounds like it'll be a great time. I guess in closing, too, I kind of want to share another observation that I have, and I know that the industry as a whole seems to be putting more of an effort into advocacy and sort of communications, and while I think we've taken tremendous strides, it's starting to pay some dividends. Admittedly, there's still a bit of work to go, but what I notice is that online, anytime you come across an article or a YouTube video that's somewhat anti-nuclear, there are 10 comments, at least, for every one anti-nuclear comment in the comment section below, with people trying to reason with them and kind of falling back on some of those tenets that Meredith Angwin shared in the first episode that we have. And I'll keep going back to it for as long as I'm doing this. And that is that you kind of got to kill them with kindness, so to speak. Not, you know, go in and beat them over the head with how ignorant they are or anything like that. And largely, I don't see any of that. A lot of it is just people, hey, you know, I think you're misinterpreting this point. Actually, nuclear waste isn't a big deal, you know, so on and so forth. If you keep that up, I think you'll start to see more good news stories like what I talked about here in the beginning. You know, I'm happy that this is probably one of the more upbeat episodes that I've had in a while, and there's a lot of good news coming. But we got to keep the momentum up. Keep working on the public advocacy side of things. Keep working on writing to your senators, state, local, federal, whatever, to get them to believe that nuclear is part of the solution in the future, because it is. And with initiatives like this and the exciting things going on with advanced nuclear, I have a feeling that this is just the beginning. So hopefully that's a good start to 2019 for everybody, and I hope to see more stories like that in the future. I'm Doug Hartmeyer, signing off, this time for Radio Nuclear. Take care.